This is Timothy C. Ward, and I love Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding. Oh,
man.
And now, constructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by a rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Thank you for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. I am your host, Timothy C. Ward. I am an author, a fan of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Today I locked my keys in my car, and I'm going to be a father. So lots of exciting things going on in my life, and today we're going to talk about Japanese monsters. So that sounds like a fitting end to my evening. I'm very pleased to have on the show some people from 01 Publishing, Josh Finney, Kat Rocha, and Patrick McAvoy. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hello.
Congratulations.
Yes, absolutely.
You like how I snuck that in there?
I didn't know locking your keys in your car was a prerequisite for being a father, but that explains why I am not one.
It's actually pretty easy. That might be the easier part of becoming a father, locking your keys in the car. But
suddenly all sorts of euphemisms.
Yeah. it wasn't going to happen, but I locked the keys. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's something about picking locks in there somewhere.
Okay, so we are on the line today to talk about World War Kaiju, the Kickstarter campaign put together through 01 Publishing. First, let's get to know you guys a little bit. Should we start with Kat, ladies first?
Oh, okay. My name is Kat Rocha. I am the co-owner of 01 Publishing. I'm also, you could consider me as one of the editors on World War Kaiju. And I guess I could also be the, talent wrangler?
Talent wrangler. You did a little bit of the monster, early monster development.
Yeah, did that too. So I have my fingerprints all over a bunch of it, but mostly it's Josh and Patrick.
She's the brain of the operation.
I'm terrible about talking about what I do.
Okay, then I can step in. She's kind of a facilitator. As Mr. Writer Guy, I can say I keep very odd hours. I have... would you say some very trying work habits? And I have the benefit of working with someone, an editor, and my wife is my editor and manager. And in that sense, she can allow me the space and environment I need to create without me going totally insane. And while there's no specific credit that you ever see in a book for that, I would say that most writers out there at some point probably owe a great deal of thanks to their wife in that category of why I was able to finish this book and why I still have some hair left.
Mm-hmm. She's
why
editor,
I'm not on drugs. Or
editor with benefits.
Yes.
Yeah, editor with benefits.
See, you know, Philip K. Dick left his wife. He ended up on drugs and in a box.
So there you go.
See? Richard Matheson stayed with his wife. Huh?
Yeah,
Stephen King.
Yes, that I am very also appreciative of my wife helping me out. Okay, so Josh, what are your skills besides having strange habits?
For this project, I was the originator of the concept. I guess you'd call me in TV terms or editorial, the head writer. The idea pretty much came about after I'd finished Titanium Rain Part 2, we can talk about that later. But I needed to get away from the headspace that a war story will bring. And so I dove into, you know, something, one of my loves of my youth, which was kaiju cinema. And from that, we can get into it more later, but that's how World War Kaiju first started. My place in all of this is, again, I write it. I've kind of got the story arc in my head. And then, I guess, what would you say? I do layout and lettering, and I talk to Patrick a lot about the art.
Okay.
Is that fair enough, Patrick?
That sounds right.
Okay.
Okay, so how about you, Patrick? Tell us a little bit about your background, too.
I started in multimedia, animation and that sort of thing, and started doing illustration about 10 years ago. And I've done a lot of science fiction, fantasy, horror for games and books and that kind of thing. I worked on the Call of Cthulhu collectible card game pretty extensively, and then the Arkham Horror board game from the same company, Fantasy Flight. And then I also worked on their Game of Thrones collectible card game. I did about 100 cards for that.
Did George R. R. Martin say something nice about your work?
He did. He's a really awesome person. I was working on that, and I happened to be at San Diego Con. This was about seven, eight years ago. And I was just walking around early one day at the con, and I noticed that George R. R. Martin was signing. And I happened to have a few of my Game of Thrones cards with me. I said, oh, wouldn't that be neat if I got a few cards signed by George Martin? And so I actually stood in line with all the regular human beings, and about 20 minutes of standing, I got up to him, and he, you know, was signing it. And I said, hey, you know, I did this. This is my art. I've been working on Game of Thrones for a couple of years now. And he was so nice. He was just the nicest guy in the world. He said, oh, well, hey, hang out here for a while. And he had me come back, you know, behind the table with him and just chatted while he was signing stuff for people. And he said he really liked my stuff. And he hoped I wasn't going to run off and get better money elsewhere, because all of the artists seem to go work for Wizards of the Coast and whatnot. And he was just really, really nice. And I had a great time meeting him. So that's my little George R. R. Martin story. It didn't blossom in anything else. You know, we didn't become poker buddies or anything, but he's a good guy.
So you're part of the art, and you're part of the art team then?
Yeah. Oh, and then I stopped talking, and and there we go. So what I am on World War Kaiju is pretty much, I'm most of the art team. I'll take the script from Josh and just turn it into a fully realized page. I'll do the layout of the page and then run it by Josh, and we'll talk about all the things that I've changed from his original script ideas. And then I scan in the pencils and go over it in Photoshop mostly, and a program called Painter and a few other little programs here and there, and turn it into the full color sort of painted page that you see here. It's really my same technique that I use for my illustration art, only I'm doing it panel by panel in the comic book. I've got a little bit of help on the team in that Kat and Josh both did a little bit of the preliminary monster design, which was really nice to start with. So I knew what they were thinking of, and I could take it from there.
We gave you about 10% concept sketches, and then you bloomed. You just took it and just said, okay, I got it. I know what the look is now. I got your feel. Bam.
Yeah, it was something like that. I mean, it was easy because we had a lot of the same touchstones, you know, pop culture references. We pretty much got because we all had I wouldn't say the same upbringing or anything, but certainly the same likes and dislikes to a very large extent. And so I was kind of able to get what they were thinking. You know, it's giant monsters. It's got a sense of humor. It's a love letter to the kaiju movies. And it's a kind of a tongue-in-cheek Cold War adventure. And, you know, just say those things to me, and I think a certain thing, and as luck would have it, it's exactly the certain thing that they were thinking. So that worked out pretty well. And so I started designing the monsters first. I spent quite a while just doing monster designs for them, and that was really fun, and it turned into, well, why don't I try rendering a few of them? And I was rendering them, and that came out great. So, you know, we sort of kind of slid into, okay, Patrick's doing all the art on the book. I'm getting a little help from Josh as well, because on some of the things I do, as many artists do these days, I'll start with a 3D render of some items just to get, you know, the perspective or the shading or whatnot right. And Josh is a really accomplished 3D artist, so I've been using him as an asset, let us say. So I'll send him the sketch and say, hey Josh, think you can do something that kind of looks like this, and he'll whip out a really cool 3D thing that I can use for reference. So that's been very helpful too. But yeah, for the most part, I'm doing all the art myself.
Okay, so go ahead, Josh.
Oh, I was going to say, one really cool thing about Patrick coming on board with this project is, prior to it, we knew Patrick decently. We'd known each other primarily from hanging out at various conventions, and in that regard, knowing that he was just a hell of a lot of fun to go out to restaurants and after-con parties with, or hanging out at the booth with, he was always a lot of fun. It wasn't until we started working together that we realized, oh yeah, you're into kind of a lot of the retro mid-20th century artwork. You're into a lot of the same movie. It was really cool to find out that we clicked on a lot of levels. So
it really was neat. We should mention that, yeah, where we did meet was, we were both working for a company called Arkea, which has recently merged with Boom Studios. They do really high-quality graphic novels, beautiful, beautifully printed, high-end graphic novels. And they had, of course, Titanium Rain came out, and I was just working on one called Starkweather Immortal, which is more of a modern fantasy story. And so we ended up going to the same conventions, being at the Arkea booth and signing together and going out and hanging, and as one does at a convention. So that was where we really all got acquainted. And yay, I'm glad we did. There's one great thing Arkea did for us.
So as I'm learning, I just finished one of my novels, and I've been brainstorming my next novel. And in this process, I've really been thinking about what genres I'm the most interested in, so that my next project I'll have a ton of enthusiasm about. What's your guys' enthusiasm about writing about kaiju?
Well, for me, when I came into the whole comic scene, and when I decided, no, I'm going to make a career out of writing, I'd kind of come from the school of the early to late 80s of science fiction. And that would, of course, be cyberpunk, a lot of William Gibson, John Shirley, a little bit later, Jeff Noon, Walter John Williams was kind of what I grew up on through my teenage years. And I found I kept coming back to. And then that, of course, led to the new wave being Harlan Ellison, Philip K. Dick, some of the harder classics like that. And when I entered comics, that was my desire. I wanted to bring that to comics, that level of sci-fi, which I feel to a degree it still lacks. As far as what I write, there are themes I continually return to. They tend to be universally dark. I don't view a lot of my writing as depressive or as dark as other people say it is, but I guess it is. And with kaiju, that really was a desire to do something that was, it still has an edge. Don't get me wrong. This is not a cute Godzilla film from its, it has its wackiness from the 70s when Godzilla got really wacky and a lot of the kaiju cinema got wacky. That element's in this kaiju story. But don't be confused. This story has an edge to it. But I wanted to do something that was a little bit more satirical, something that could just open the door to doing balls out weird, strange. I have a love of weird. I have a deep love of the absurd. And I'm obsessed with world building. It was just so much fun to go back and merge all these various tropes and mythologies of classic kaiju cinema and classic 50s sci-fi cinema and merge it with the real world politics and real world cultural, the 50s and then the 60s were a cauldron of cultural and political change. And so to merge that and overlap it with the media it created was just incredibly fun. And I think Patrick's now taking that to 11, where he'll know where the idea came from, where I'll be parodying something, or I'll be mocking or satirizing something real, but putting it in the context of this Japanese sci-fi, American sci-fi context. And then he'll come in and he'll throw similar references and take that concept even further.
It's a great opportunity to use all of the pop culture references that we have from being all the three of us really so steeped in the pop culture of the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, which, a lot of people now don't really think a lot about. And, we all listen to old radio plays and, read old comics and old novels and yes. histories. And it's nice to be able to use this in a really fun and nerdy and literary way together and really build something big.
And I guess on one other aspect, aside from Utopias, I guess this is unfair because people haven't seen anything other than Utopias and Titanium Rain. But one thing I did a fair amount of in Titanium Rain was this kind of mixed medium storytelling where you'd have a conventional narrative, but then I'd keep throwing in world building elements and artifacts from the world to enhance and kind of build upon the story, which was, kind of pioneered or made famous by The Watchmen. And with kaiju, again, we're taking that to 11. There's a lot of non-conventional storytelling as well as the conventional narrative. And so it's great that the story's chugging along and then we cut to a newsreel and you get that. The story's moving along and you get a newspaper comic strip right in there. And that's just been incredibly fun.
Yeah, and it really got to a very, really early on, got to a very instinctive level between us where, Josh sent me a script for a couple of pages, and I looked at it, and I immediately thought, oh, it's like we're looking at a newsreel. And so I did all the art in newsreel form, and I sent it to him, sent the sketches to him, and he sort of wrote back and said, I didn't mean this at all, but it's perfect. And we're having a lot of moments like that.
Actually, really, I'll give you my exact words. I wrote this and had absolutely no idea how it would be rendered or even realized on the page. So that's actually even worse.
And before we get too far away from the reference, I wanted to say that to me, and I don't know if Josh had any of this in mind at all, but when he mentioned the new wave of science fiction, I go back, I think of the original, mid-60s Michael Moorcock New Worlds. And it's funny that a lot of the humor reminds me of when Michael Moorcock does humor. It's, sort of random references to things. And if you get the cross reference, there's a joke there. And, you have to really read it to get all of the humor. Moorcock did that just masterfully. And I think Josh is doing a lot of this too. And I think then that because we're able to collaborate, sometimes we're even, multiplying that sense of
not a maybe,
strangeness.
Certainly. That's not a maybe. That's a certainly. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, so for people who are into that era of the new wave of sci-fi, I think they'll get a lot of callbacks to at least that the feel or the mood of Moorcock's humorous work.
That's a huge compliment. Thank you, Patrick. My God, thank you.
So, Josh, you said that it started with the story and then it was world building. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Well, like I said, I'd just gotten off Titanium Rain 2, which in many ways, regarding what's in the story and what was going on outside the story at the same time, creating that second installment of the book was gut-wrenching for me. And for that very reason, once the finishing touches had been put on that book and I stepped away, I needed an escape. I needed some time away. I needed to get away from, you know, this crucible that the characters were being put through. And for that reason, I just got a kick to start watching all the old Godzilla and Gamera films. And I'm a bit obsessive compulsive, so that then immediately went to just starting to watch all the old Toho sci-fi.
And just a bit.
Just a bit. Yeah, I know. And then that led to an actual researching and studying and reading up of the history of that era and how that developed. And that fused with an already pre-existing deep knowledge of 50s and 60s U.S. sci-fi and a love for it. Got a huge love for that mid-20th century science fiction as it is anyway. And one theme that I kept continually coming back to was that a lot of people theorized that the monsters in the Toho films originally symbolized world superpowers and then started symbolizing other things such as politics, cultural upheaval, the environment. And there is some truth to that. Some people argue how much truth, but there definitely is some truth to it. Godzilla started off as being a reference to the bomb, and that first Godzilla film is not a fun jaunt. That is a dark, dark film. I think that was actually the worst thing to watch after Titanium Rain, especially the Japanese version. It didn't get wacky and fun until, Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster. But anyway, prior to that, thinking about the fact that these different creatures, different kaiju represented nations, I was laying in bed thinking about the history of the 20th century and just started, well, what if instead of the bomb being created, what if they had split this isotope, these Kai crystals called Kai-235, and it hatched kaiju monsters? That this world never developed an atomic bomb. This world actually literally had monsters. So there is no that the kaiju was a symbol. The kaiju is. And then this led to, well, what if there was a kaiju Cold War? And the irony of that being is, any way you look at it, as horrendous as a giant 50-foot radioactive monster is, the reality of the bomb is still scarier. And that led to the thought, well, you know, if we had the monsters, we probably would have fought more wars. We probably wouldn't have had mad, mutually assured destruction. We would have had mad, mutually monster-assured destruction, which isn't nearly as worse. It's bad, you know.
It just destroys a place once. It's habitable, yeah. Really soon.
And, you know, the way I think, just suddenly the pieces started falling together. Kat and I went on a little vacation. She went shopping, and as I was in the waiting room, or as she was trying on clothes for the entire day, we were going store to store, I jotted out this idea for a Cuban monster crisis, and thus, there it was. That was the birth of the concept.
And that's a good example of the the level of fairly subtle humor we've got going. Is, yes, mm-hmm. if you get the reference Cuban monster crisis, then you're totally on board with us. There's no stopping.
That is one worry. Is sometimes I think that you're going to have at least a decent working knowledge of history to really fully appreciate this. We don't hold back on that. The smarts, If you're a Michael Bay fan, forget it. Don't even bother.
And it's not like we're doing really, you know, highbrow, hoity-toity humor. It just takes a certain background to get the wackiness. It's wacky humor, but it's wacky humor that takes maybe a certain level of historical perspective to quite appreciate.
You'd need enough historical perspective to understand why a drunken phone call between Khrushchev and Castro screaming at each other about a giant radioactive dinosaur stomping on Cuba, why that's funny.
But and on the other hand, though, too, maybe it'll be a nice gateway for people who will read it and think it's just funny on its own and then say, I wonder how much of this really happened. And then they'll go back and, you know, read about the real Cuban Missile Crisis. So who knows? You never know. That sort of thing might happen, too. So it might be sort of a backwards engineering thing.
And the bizarre thing is some of the funniest moments are the true ones.
Yes, exactly.
So your press release says that the two main characters are a journalist and a retired CIA operative. Is that right?
Yes.
So how do they fit into this world? What's their story?
Realizing that this was an enormous world and an enormous span of time to cover, right? The original idea was to tell it as a... almost a Deep Throat type scenario where, hold on.
he's overcome with emotion.
Yeah, exactly. I'm choked up here. Now the idea was to tell it in kind of it's the 1970s, set in 1973, and this intrepid young idealist, child of the 60s, journalist who writes for a magazine similar to Rolling Stone, is on the trail of the truth of what happened, really. What's the secret history of the Cold War in the United States? And he gets this ex-CIA operative who he really has been sitting front row to history, who has had enough. He's pissed off. He's ready to talk. And this operative, they've met up, and you're getting all these flashbacks and this narrative to, well, then this happened. Well, I was there when this happened, and this is what really happened. And you know this? No, this is the truth about it. And it's just this continuing revealing of secrets and flashbacks to key moments in history. And so that way, you don't have to wait. You know, okay, well, the first we're going to do season one is going to be the 50s, and season two is the late 50s, and season three is the early 60s. There's almost kind of a stream of consciousness flow as we piece the mystery together. And what that deeper mystery is, I won't say because it'll ruin it. One thing, and I didn't say this, okay? I am not tooting my own horn here. I didn't say this, but a number of fans have been saying this is going to be the Watchmen of Kaiju, that it's giving it the Watchmen treatment. Now, I don't know if that's really fair, but it might give you a sense of at least the manner of storytelling.
Or at least our aspiration.
Oh, definitely aspiration, certainly.
Where we're aiming. If we could get halfway to that, we'd be really happy.
Oh, God, yeah. Of course, I don't think you'd want to shoot yourself after you read our book.
No. Good point.
So what makes you care about the journalist and the CIA operative as characters?
I'll have Patrick chime in next, because as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to visual storytelling, because, you know, I've written prose, I've written my fair amount of prose, and I've done two graphic novels, which I not only wrote, but illustrated. And in that equation, the writer creates the script, creates the story, but that's only half the work. In terms of cinematography, your artist is not only the director, or half of the director at least, your artist is also every actor. And so in that sense, your artist is controls the performance of every person. You know, half of acting is body language and facial expression, and that is the artist's job. You know, a lot of it's where the camera's placed, a lot of it's the lighting, and that is critical as well. So in that sense, that's also an answer for Patrick to give. But on my stance, where I'm at, what makes you care? That's universal. Really, that's universal for any kind of storytelling and any kind of story. You don't have to have your reader sympathize with the character. You just have to have them empathize with the character.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I wanted to create two polar opposites that find a common ground. I wanted the CIA operative to be what we would stereotypically in modern cinema and modern storytelling consider a villain, but who was a classic hero in the 50s, and that is, he is a white-bred, you know, Anglo-Saxon, blue-eyed blonde, all-American secret agent. And nowadays, his type of character, an old guy who's completely unapologetic for the work he did, believes in what he did, nowadays, that's your typical villain in a lot of these types of stories. And then we've got the intrepid idealist who is a... should we say who he looks like? Patrick?
I guess we might as well. He just very coincidentally looks like the hero of 3 Days of the Condor. And all the President's Men. Yes. just very coincidentally.
Yes, and that was purposely done, because this is someone who is full of high ideals, and, you know, it really is a believer in the cause of social justice. And in that sense, you have these two personalities clashing. And this is mine. This is my own personal issue. I don't know if this actually ever comes out in Patrick. I'll let him speak for himself. But in that sense, the conflict is you've got the World War II generation mentality explaining and justifying to their children why they did what they did and why they built the world that they built. And how much of it was, well, you know, a lot of it was, well, look, we did what we had to, or look, this wasn't our fault. And there are even portions where the CIA agent says, look, I'm sorry, we should have done it different. And I believe as Gen X, I'm a Gen Xer, I think right now many of us, not all of us, many of us are beginning to kind of feel that towards our own parents' generation of, well, why did you do it this way? Why did you give us this world? Why did you make these choices? Sometimes I think the World War II generation might have had better answers. But, you know, I'm biased. I think we're always very critical of our parents. And that relationship of the two generations clashing is an underlying theme and what drove a lot of this back and forth between the two. And so naturally, that's going to give you something to at least empathize, if not sympathize, with the characters. And hopefully you'll see the humanity in both of them.
That's great. Wow, I don't have much left to say after that, but no, that's absolutely true. I guess from the storytelling point of view, from the directorial or acting point of view, and also set design, I am trying to get across that relationship wherever I can. Yeah, I don't know if anyone out there is really interested in the sort of behind-the-scenes storytelling thoughts I had, but if you look up the 17-page preview, as you get towards the end, we finally do meet our two narrators, our narrator and the journalist that he's talking to, sort of face-to-face. And it gave me an opportunity. We're supposed to be in a an old warehouse somewhere. So I very purposefully made it a really, really cold warehouse and made it, you know, it's all done in blues. They've got, you can see the breath coming out of their mouths, and it's kind of, you know, the Cold War, well, there's that, but it's the relation between the two generations at that point was just frozen over. And what can they do to start to talk to each other and start to have a dialogue, because they don't trust each other, really. There's this, like Josh was saying, there's a guy from the Cold War generation and a guy from the post-60s generation where everything changed. And what common ground do they have, and how can they overcome this huge gulf between them? So I did things like very purposefully always put props between them. And when they're in the same... Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Didn't even notice that.
Well, no, see, that's visual storytelling. That's subliminal. I got that sense, but it didn't really register till you said it.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And I had already mentioned to Josh, you know, wherever possible, it'll be nice to put their word balloons between the two of them. So I left a lot of room for the word balloons to separate them as well. So little things like that are happening as we go through it. And then their relative sizes in the panel are going to change depending on who's making a particular point. And so things like that hopefully give you a subconscious idea of what's happening between these two characters, and then you're really getting an opportunity to buy into the fact that they're opposed, even though maybe they are eventually going after the same thing. You know, a lot of what you're carrying is, well, you hope these two are going to get together, but it really seems like they can't. So there's that tug of war happening. So I'm just trying to help that on a visual storytelling level wherever I can, which is the beauty of comics. You would have to somehow block your scene and sort of work around saying that if it were just prose. You know, you could be sort of on the nose and say, oh, they were standing on different sides of the room as though they were separated by something, and then nobody would read your book because it would be stupid. But you can do things like that with comics because you really do have the words and the pictures telling two complementary parts of a story, almost like music, you know, where you have the words and the music working together when it's working all, you know, when it's working its best, the music helps the words make the emotional point. And same with comics, the art should be helping the words make that emotional point.
I think in place of music, you've got color.
Right. Yes, very much so. And, you know, Josh and I both come from a pretty musical background, so we have that in common as well. So yeah. I think we think in those terms a lot, too, just sort of without even talking about it. We both have that kind of background.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've had these pictures that you guys have on the Kickstarter page up on my background, and I only had one of them. The last of the four before it gets to the incentives, that's been up on my screen the whole time, and I've just been, I mean, I'm mesmerized by it the whole time, and what we've been talking for a half hour already. So yeah, very excellent artwork. Definitely
fantastic. Thanks.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the dynamics of the time frame and some of the pledge type things that people can do, some of the stretch goals.
So, let's leave that to the business black belt here.
Well, yes, the Kickstarter is to, first and foremost to raise money so that Patrick can finish the book, because, you know, Patrick is a working artist, and well, you know,
he needs to eat and pay rent.
Yeah,
or he'll die.
Like, you know, Cold War Kaiju has actually been a project in production for the last 2 years, and both Josh and Patrick have been working on it when they can, especially Patrick, you know, in between other projects. And
what happened is, you know, we've been chugging along. Patrick was working in, you know, brief starts and jumps when he could between jobs. He's very, you know, we were actually very lucky to get Patrick. He's very in demand in both the realms of fantasy art and gaming. So in that sense, we were extremely lucky. He had always been our first choice. And what happened is we saw that there's going to be a Godzilla movie, and more importantly, there's Pacific Rim coming out. And it was, okay, you know what? You know, we can't wait any longer. If anyone, if there was ever a time that the public was going to be receptive to this idea, if there was ever going to be a time that I could say, yeah, well, it's a story about the Cold War, but instead of missiles, it's monsters. If there was ever a time that people weren't going to give me a look like I was insane for saying that, it was going to be now. So let's get it on Kickstarter and get it out there. And let me tell you, plenty of publishers had looked at me like I was out of my mind.
So, yeah.
Well, to be fair, they do that anyway.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, that's not the first time. That is true.
Well, usually they tell you to dumb it down.
I don't want to go into it. I don't want to complain.
Okay.
It's been such a good interview. Let's not rant.
Okay. Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, first and foremost, it's to raise money so that Patrick can finish the book, as well as get it printed. Now, for the stretch goals, currently we want to raise $15,000 to have the first part of the story printed and told. World War Kaiju will be told in six parts complete. But it was always intended that the first three parts would be put together into one book. So the stretch goals will allow that to happen. If we can meet our stretch goals, the first one being 25,000, part one and two will be put together. And if we can reach the 35,000 stretch goal, then all three parts will be put together.
Yeah, and the beauty of it, all three parts, is the price of the book does not change. It stays $25 regardless, but your book goes from being 80 pages to 200 plus pages.
Exactly. And this way
These parts aren't meager.
They're not meager. No, these are actual full chapters.
Graphic novels.
Yeah,
each
graphic
could
novels,
be a graphic
yeah.
novel on its own.
Yes.
Exactly. And this is the way that we always intended the book to be shown.
Oh, so stretch goals are very important. I think we should also mention that our, we may have mentioned it in passing before, but it really does bear repeating that our incentives, I think, are very creative in that they aren't
part
just
of the storytelling.
Yeah, yeah, they aren't just a thing that you get that's cool. They are a thing that you get that's cool, and it increases your enjoyment of the story because it's an artifact from the world. That we're creating, like propaganda posters or the drinking game,
Stalin's drinking game.
Yes, Stalin's drinking game, or postcards that not only look like they were made in this world, but have actual
secret correspondence between the journalist and agent.
Yes, so it all helps build a bigger world. So the incentives are part of the storytelling, and in that way, the people who are investing in our project are helping to create this world with us. That's really cool.
So, what do I have to do to get this red armadillo poster? The thing is hilarious.
Not very much. Can you believe only $35 gets you the book and Red Armadillo?
Yep.
It says he will decimate and obliterate the West, and then he's got this just grin on his face. Oh, that's funny. That would be hilarious to have on my wall. So you guys need to support
love
this
that character.
Yeah.
We've even got a friend who's been working on a plush doll version of Red Armadillo.
Yes.
Yes.
Nice.
Actually, he's already becoming a fan favorite, which is great.
Everyone loves Red Armadillo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just to give you a little backstory on that character, Fat Man was America's first kaiju, and it turned out to be one of the most powerful kaiju. Fat Man was hatched at Alamogordo at the Trinity test site, and it was used to end the First World War when they unleashed Fat Man on Tokyo. Shortly thereafter, Russia got hold of the kaiju technology and started making their own, and unfortunately their very first hatching was this big shaggy dog monster. And he really wasn't, he was dangerous, but not quite the horrific beast that they had hoped for. So they put him, they painted him red or dyed him red and put riveted spikes and armor all over him and claimed he was the Red Armadillo. And it became their national symbol until they hatched a more powerful kaiju called Proleterodactyl.
More of that inside jokes, right?
Yep.
Yes. And I loved coming up with Red Armadillo. For some reason, he really clicked with me. And I gave him that insane glint in his eye.
Yes.
Like, he just wants to have fun, but he's so insane, you're in big trouble.
Yes. actually, for your listeners, the best deal on there, if you don't want to go for any of the unique items, and there are a handful of items that they're only like 10 only exist, but for anyone who wants the best deal that doesn't want to get a unique or limited item, is the Super Deluxe Pack. You get all 5 of the propaganda posters. You get a mini comic called Duck and Cover, and it has Little Boy, one of the kaiju, telling kids about what to do if a kaiju attacks their city. It comes with the postcards, and you get the book. But the other nice thing is, along with getting all this stuff for $55, the moment we start hitting the stretch goals, you get anyone who's $55 or over gets all the items from the stretch goals. Like the magnetic poetry kit for kaiju and the extra poster we'll make and some other stuff.
As well as, of course, the bigger book.
Yes.
Exactly.
So, yeah, the moral of the story is give us lots of money so we can give you an awesome product. We want to give things away to you.
Yes, we do.
We do.
And so this project goes through till when?
I believe it's August 12th.
Yes, that's a Monday. So if you get really drunk over the weekend, we hope you can recover by Monday morning to help us with our final push.
Well, you guys have been doing well so far. Don't necessarily want to say a number because I'm sure it'll be higher by the time we post this. But
let's hope so.
I'm getting excited.
Cool.
So are we.
Yay. We're really, really jazzed. Yeah, we're really happy. It's doing well so far. You know, what's weird about doing a Kickstarter is you sort of start, and then people that you know kind of kick in some money, and then people in your, say, you know, your Facebook or Twitter friends, you know, you see some of those names pop up and give you money. But then it's so cool that it takes on a life of its own, and people you didn't even know are suddenly backing you and talking about you on their blogs. And, you know, we have one fellow who's been creating fan art of various propaganda posters and movie posters for us. And, you know, just because they like the idea, and you start to get all these total strangers who begin to create a whole, fan base on their own without you even helping, and it's the neatest thing. So that's been really exciting to watch happen.
I've been thrilled at just how much people have embraced the project and how much press has just jumped on this idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that always feels good to realize that people appreciate your work and your art and what you're doing. So, a sense of justice, I suppose, and this is a personal gripe. It's always bothered me that Patrick's name was not as well known as his art. And so for people to finally start matching a name to this guy who's created so much art that everyone's seen makes me happy. It's been a long time coming.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks. You guys have always been great fans and supporters, and it's really nice of you to say so. Well, if nothing else, people know how to say McAvoy now. It's one of those names you read, you don't know how to say it. So. If nothing else, it's not a mystery.
And it's also rewarding that no one looks at me like I'm insane anymore when I mention the concept. Now they look at me like I'm insane for other reasons.
Yeah, exactly. They say, well, at least that concept isn't crazy. They're still backing away slowly.
You'll have to.
I won't make any comments.
You'll have to make a red armadillo hat or something and then put some type of googly eyes or something for your Halloween costume. Ooh. That would be fun.
That's a cool idea. A red armadillo hat with big googly eyes. I love it.
I'm literally writing it down right now.
Oh, we could even attach floppy dog ears to the sides.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. Okay. Yeah, don't be surprised if you see that the next convention we're at.
Yes. Yeah, I would love. I'm waiting for the day that we do get World War Kaiju cosplay. That would be the ultimate reward.
Yeah, although probably not porn cosplay, but because that'd be a little disturbing. I guess it's something I would like to hear about without necessarily seeing.
Agreed.
Okay, is there anything else you guys wanted to mention about this project? I think we've pretty well wrapped it up.
Yeah,
that's about it.
Go to www.worldwarkaiju, that's K-A-I-J-U.com, to find out all the things that you want to know about World War Kaiju, the setting, what the comic looks like, and the Kickstarter, yes. As well as the creators.
And we've got a great animated trailer that if that doesn't bring you in, I don't know what will.
Yeah, and you could waste, you know, a good hour or two just looking at the art on the Kickstarter page, so it's good stuff.
Oh, yeah, because we have the monster profiles, so you actually can see the various creatures of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In fact, I believe we're due to release...
The NATO
yeah. monsters.
Yeah, we unlock them every couple weeks.
Yeah, if you go directly to that worldwarkaiju.com, just so people know specifically, that is where you can see the 17 page preview, the first 17 pages of the book, as well as all these monsters and background and the video and of course the link to Kickstarter. So yeah, be sure to go and get lots of free entertainment.
And I will put links in the show notes for this post to your guys' websites, to 01 Publishing. I don't believe we were recording when I said this, but I read Utopiates, their graphic novel, and listened to Titanium Rain, and very fast and intense fiction, and a good picture of what's to come, I think, with this Kaiju project. So good job on that, guys, and audience, go check that stuff out, too.
Yeah, you can actually hear Titanium Rain for, you can download the 2-hour audio drama for $5 on iTunes. And our cyberpunk noir or biotech noir story, Utopiates, is available on Amazon for $13. And I'd love people to check those out as well. But right now, support the Kickstarter. That's more important.
Yeah. Don't waste your money on that other crap.
Yeah, it doesn't have Patrick. Okay.
All right, folks. Well, thanks again for coming on. Thank you so much for your sponsorship, and I'm glad to meet you, and I'm glad to find out about this project for purely selfish fiction and picture monsters reasons.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, good meeting you.
Yeah, it was great meeting you.
Head over to Kickstarter.com and search for Kaiju. That's all you have to search for. K-A-I-J-U, or World War Kaiju.
Visit Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing for show notes, links, reviews, special guests, videos, and more. Email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musically.com. No authors were seriously damaged in the making of this podcast.